The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcode.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcode Podcast, a production of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. Am I the most consistently present person on this podcast? Yes. Am I the most important person on this podcast? Of course not. It's like saying Roy Moore is a U.S. Senator from Alabama. He's not. It's ridiculous. No. Listeners, the more important folks on the show are my co-hosts. Say buenos dias to Levi Endelman.
Hola.
Give a hearty greeting to Tony Rosenberg.
Hello.
Tip your hat to Mark Mubarak.
Hey.
And a good day to you, sir, Rob Humble.
Hello.
Gentlemen, I'm glad to have you here. I know that you're on break right now, all of you,
yeah,
right?
That
pretty much all of you.
Mm-hmm.
Some of you are studying for an important national examination coming up.
Step one.
Yes.
Hope you're enjoying yourselves with that. Is it like studying for a regular test in school?
No.
Yeah. No, it's not. Do you want to elaborate?
It's like studying for a test that's actually important.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a system? I mean, are you just like reviewing your notes?
I have a kid. So like a lot of people, I did one of the study groups. And so we did like a chapter every week throughout the, I think we started in like September. And,
mm-hmm.
and then I would do questions based on the chapter that corresponded to the week.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I'm doing just like blocks of 40 questions from U World, which is a question bank that many of you will end up using someday. And not targeting any specific areas, just trying to model like what the test will be like. And it's brutal right now. It makes me feel like I didn't do, like, where was I?
Exactly. All these little things.
Did I miss one of the years?
Where did this come up before?
But I'm told it will get better.
So, like, there's not even a sense of familiarity sometimes. It's like, what is that?
I assume this is supposed to be a clue, something in, like, the vignette. And I'm like, but I don't know what it means.
No, that sounds fun. Well, I'm glad you're here. I like to start off the show with listener feedback and questions as often as possible. Now, I could play the cynical game of putting those questions at the end of the show in the hopes that it will encourage people to stay for the entire show. It's not how we roll.
Give the people what they want.
I put them at the beginning because they are the most important part of the show, which is why I'm glad to have two listener questions this week, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's start with Arman, who's calling to let us know whether or not our advice ruined his life.
Hey, Dave and friends. My name is Arman. I'm at the George Washington University Medical School, and this is actually a follow-up to a call I had made before. I had asked you guys about some advice on kind of sacrificing it all to be a medical student, letting go of the passions and the things that made you happy just to be a studious medical student. And the advice you gave, by the way, was fantastic. So I'm a semester in the medical school, and I've noticed that by employing your guys' advice about how to be a medical student and how to, like, keep your passions and your outside experiences that you love, I've seen an insignificant dip in my grades, but a substantial increase in my happiness since, like, the first couple weeks of medical school. So thank you very much. You guys give great advice. And so while I was here, I was going to ask about another question or another topic for you guys, and that is about advice in general. I find it very difficult sometimes to internalize and accept other people's advice. I mean, we get advice as medical students from literally everywhere on the internet, from the Shortcode Podcast, from other people at our school who might be a year older than us or a couple years older than us, or people in our class. And I've noticed that it's so hard to accept other people's advice and internalize it. So, for example, someone might say, you should use this study resource while you're studying, and I might be like, I don't really know. I know how I like to study, and I don't know if I'd like that. And then, you know, later on, like a month into studying, I'll start using that resource and be like, man, I really wish I'd use this resource way beforehand. So I'm interested in your thoughts about why this is. I'm hopefully not the only person who's experienced this, but I'm interested into what your guys' thoughts are about this. Thanks again for the podcast, Dave and friends. I hope your year 2017 has been great, and I hope your 2018 is going to be even better. So happy new year, and thanks again.
Thank you for that lovely bit of feedback on our advice. I mean, I like to think we give good advice, but you know, in the absence of positive reinforcement, sometimes who knows?
True.
So what do you think of Armand's question? Why is it so difficult to take advice?
I guess in the context of like when he's asking specifically about study resources and things like that, how appropriate when we're gearing up with step one is stakes is kind of the first thing. You get a little worried of like, am I doing the right thing by following your sample size of one? And why is your thought process better than so-and-so's who might be giving something else? So I think there's like a trust element to it that at least that's what I struggle with of like when I take someone's advice, I want them to be as similar to my style as possible. And there's always that little part of me that says, you don't want to spin your wheels. Just do
what
it.
Do you know?
Do what you think is right and ignore everybody else. And then you just jump back and forth.
I think kind of on the flip side of that, too, there's the how somebody describes as a FOMO, like fear of missing out. Like, and then, you know, you can take that to the opposite
the
extreme,
other extreme yeah.
And try to take everybody's advice. And then you, at least in my experience, because I've had that a time or two, and you really end up just doing nothing, you know, everything equally poorly. So
I don't know. I think for me, it kind of speaks to a louder issue, maybe. Just kind of like an intrinsic personality trait that some people have, that like learning things the hard way and kind of having to fall on your face or figure out that, oh, maybe I should have listened to that. And I kind of fall into that category. So sometimes someone will give me advice and I'll be like, I still think I know better than that person, or I think I know what would work better for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I end up finding out that, you know, maybe I'm right, but maybe I'm also wrong. And if I'm wrong, then it kind of clues me into, oh, maybe you should be more receptive. And I think I've gotten better at that over time. But
I think we have this intrinsic. So we of course, we're going to listen to the voices in our head more than we're going to listen to the voices outside of our head. And
some of us have more voices in our
well,
head than others.
I mean, yeah, that's a problem. But yeah, for sure, I feel like, you know, we trust ourselves more than we trust other people. And we always think, oh, but they don't, like, I think Mark was kind of implying, you know, like, oh, you don't know me.
Yeah.
You know,
of what has worked in the past for, you know, your own situation. Yeah. I think a good example would be like with UWorld, like you were talking about, Rob.
Yeah.
Did you start using it before your dedicated period?
I did not.
You did not, right? And there's some strong feelings, right? Some people are like, it's such a good resource. You got to use it as much as possible. You should go through it 2 times, 3 times. Others are like, no, it's such an important resource. We all agree on that. Don't waste it. You got to wait till the dedicated. Then you'd use it then.
Got to savor it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not sad. I don't know. Yeah, I had to pull back from the savoring part.
For but, those of you who can't see what you're listening to, I rolled my eyes just now.
I mean, people have told me similar things in terms of, like, I took an extra month off to study, so mm-hmm. I'm not taking step until the end of February. And, like, they sent out, like, the email, and they're like, actually, like, there's no proof that, like, taking more time leads to an increase in score. If anything, it might slightly decrease your score. And then I'm just sitting there thinking, like, yeah, but of that sample size of people that did delay it for an extra month, how many of them would have done way worse had they taken it a month before that? And the fact that they're like darn near close to average or smack on average for the class, how much of that is due to them taking the mm-hmm. extra month?
Yeah, so, this is the problem with advice. You know, you get advice in like you should do this because this. But then there's sort of a lack of, and especially in you guys' case, I imagine, like, as sort of science-minded people, you sort of want more data. And that data just isn't
isn't given to you a lot of times with advice.
Am I allowed to say evidence-based?
On this podcast, you have to say it twice.
Evidence-based.
Yeah.
I think so, like, just generally about like making decisions and taking advice, I've noticed that my approach has changed some. Like, I don't know, in the past, a lot of times would maybe ask some people for advice or get like a handful of people that I trust their advice and then do what my gut thought anyways. But now I kind of like throw everything at the wall. I'll ask a wide selection of people, like what their approach was and how they, so like, for example, with STEP, like I talked to a lot of people about like, how did they frame their dedicated study time? How did they do the review? Did they use UWorld before dedicated or just during dedicated? And just kind of got like, collected that data, so to speak, and then just kind of, I'm like, well, what works for me, and like what, like you're taking extra time, I didn't take extra time, I think the result will probably be the same.
Seeing where the current just, goes for yourself.
Yeah, you just have to, I don't know, make your own decision in the context of
what you
what's
know
going on. Yeah,
well, for me it's like I knew coming right off of finishing clerkships and then it's holiday, it's like I knew it would take me at least a week or a week and a half to like get in the swing of things of studying, and I felt like, you know, I'd like to feel like I have enough time that if I'm not crazy productive right off the bat, it's not going to kill me, it's not the end of the world. So it's like I knew that going in, that I'm not like that type of person that can just be like, sweet, just took my last test of my first clerkship year, gonna study 10 hours a day now, like gonna be great. I can't do that, so I kind of took that into consideration when I took the time.
There's also the I mean, I think we've kind of touched on it, like fear of the unknown. Like if you accept advice, it usually means that you have to step outside of your own comfort zone. We've sort of touched on that a little bit here. Inertia is another reason I think why people don't take advice, is because, you know, it's hard to change who you are and how you look at things and all that kind of stuff and how you do things.
Even being in familiar pain is sometimes more comfortable than being in unfamiliar
pain. Right.
Yeah.
Seeking out like self-affirming advice or like, oh, you're just going to reaffirm what I already want to do.
Right.
Right.
Of some relevance is a article that I read on Vox this week about how many medical treatments are don't have any evidence to really back them up at all. In fact, some of them that are common have evidence to refute their utility. So this is not just something that just, you know, students suffer from, apparently. This past November, for instance, Lancet published a study on the effectiveness of stents with patients with heart disease. And the study basically said it was no better than placebo in treating things like chest pain or performance on stress tests or
but the algorithm
things of that nature. So hey, we've learned something, right? Everybody will be like, oh, we're not going to use stents anymore. Well, you know, history says otherwise. I mean, there's all kinds of treatments out there that are used every day for things, for conditions that, you know, doctors just continue to use despite the fact that, you know, there's evidence to the contrary. Things like arthroscopic knee debridement and lavage to repair osteoarthritis and meniscal tears. Imaging tests for uncomplicated headaches. Cardiac imaging for patients without heart problems. Imaging for patients with low back pain. Spinal fusion to ease the pain caused by worn discs. Subacromial decompression for shoulder pain. These were all cited in the article as things that have been more or less disproven, or at least there's no evidence that they actually do anything. But they're expensive procedures. I mean, and so they cost a lot of money and they cost patients a lot of time and energy and effort. And
they also pay a lot of money.
And yeah, there are, you know, so there's all kinds of confounding variables as to why, in this case, it's easier to disregard the evidence and say, well, we're going to keep doing this.
I was at a family Christmas with some of my in-laws. Last week, I guess, and one of my husband's cousins is a nurse practitioner, and her mom was they weren't able to come home, so her mom was telling me about the clinic she works in and how the provider that runs the clinic does all of these things as part of like a screening workup and like having been through a year of rotations now, I'm like, oh, that's not indicated. Oh, like, why are they doing all these things? Like, why are you giving healthy people echoes? That's ridiculous. And I think, yeah, a lot of it does come back to, it does, you do get reimbursed for something like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard about
this,
but there might be some healthcare cost problems.
Action is super desirable.
I think, yeah, like you said, part of it too is just that patients come to the doctor having some perceived, you know, you don't go to the doctor necessarily if you're healthy unless it's just for a checkup. But, you know, what they don't want to hear is go home, you're fine. We're not going to do anything because, you know, they don't understand. The evidence doesn't say we need to do anything. They're like, you're not doing anything. You're not doing your job.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's, I mean, part of our job to explain to them like what the evidence actually is.
Yeah.
And kind of meet them at whatever level they're at in terms of being able to understand the material. Like with some patients that are, you know, maybe more capable of understanding things on a scientific level, I've actually brought in like an article a couple times to be like, hey, like this is why we're deciding to do this or why we're not doing this. And it really helps them to be like, oh, like that makes sense. You're actually going based off of something. It's not just that you don't feel like doing it or there's not room today. And so you're telling me to go home. And I think that, yeah, I think it's our job to kind of meet the patient where they're at and explain to them.
I think that's like one of the biggest challenges too, is like striking that right balance between informing and maybe advocating one way or the other and like giving them the information that they can digest, making it sufficient, but not overly complicated.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like Dave brought up the example of like imaging for low back pain. And it's like most of the time low back pain is like, you know, extremely common. Like you got a new mattress or whatever, like it'll go away in a few weeks or a month and maybe you need some physical therapy, but most of the time it's musculoskeletal and there's nothing imaging would do. So in that case, it's like a patient's like, I'm actively in pain. This has been going on a long time. Why aren't you doing anything? Why aren't you looking at it with a picture? And so I think to be able to explain it to them and say, hey, look, like most of the time, this is what it is. And we want to try these things first because of how expensive imaging is and all of these other things. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think that it's definitely important to do.
Part of it too is if they go to another provider with back pain specifically, like if you search, you'll find they're going to have, you know, some evidence of degeneration or just, you know, age related changes. And it goes back to kind of that self-reaffirming, like this was it. This is why I have this pain. It was missed. It's hard.
Yeah.
I think what an interesting flip though is when the provider is suggesting care that is not evidence backed. Because JAMA had a couple days ago with vitamin D and calcium, a huge meta study that shows not that effective.
Yeah.
And I read that and I was super surprised. And I still took vitamin D every day since. They included. And it's one of those things of like, you really put it in my face. Like this is it's a really impressive, you know, I really try to find some holes in it. And
there's not many,
but I'm still going to take vitamin D.
Well, like in a situation like that, it's like, You actually probably worked to some extent to develop this habit, you know, and to be like,
I'm not letting it go.
Throw it away. It's like, oh, well, shit.
All in.
I think what you, regarding the imaging stuff, my suggestion is that we make a device that you can just whip out of your pocket and like scan the person. Doesn't actually do anything. You scan the person, be like, I'm using this advanced medical imaging tool.
So fraud.
Don't charge for it. You know?
Star Trek did
it's called a PUS. It's placebo ultrasound.
Well, that's, some people will say that every once in a while. Oh, well, this is it's a therapeutic x-ray.
Not to be confused with
just to calm things down a little bit.
Not to be confused with the POS.
I mean, it's an idea. Yeah, you could get an ultrasound machine and a little iPhone ultrasound thing that they make now.
Yeah.
I've always thought it would be awesome because I love imaging, but I like people too much to go into radiology. But I think it would be awesome if we all got like standard like CT scans or whatever at specific intervals in our life. And then we could go to the doctor and be like, here's my baseline CT scan. And then they would pull it up and it would be like a 3D hologram of your entire body. And then it's like,
nobody ever, wants that of my body.
If you ever got, it's like, I'm thinking about this from the context of like, I did a couple of years of neuro-oncology research, and it's like a lot of times it would have been really helpful to know, when did this cancer start? How long has it been there, to figure out how fast it's growing, how aggressive it is. So it's like, if you had these like routine scans,
if you knew it wasn't there like 10 years ago, you're
right. You know. So I don't know. I think that'd be sweet, but
well,
probably never happen.
It's an idea.
If you drove, you'd have to drive down like MRI cost like crazy to do something like that.
Yeah. Or we could just use the PUS.
True, true.
Well, let's, thanks for your question, Armand. Thanks for your
roaring endorsement.
Roaring endorsement. That's what I was going for. For your roaring endorsement of our advice.
Rate us on iTunes.
Right.
It's what we really would like.
Our next listener, Samuel, got in touch asking us to help him work through his concerns about prestige, privilege, and biases in medicine.
First, I love your show. I listen to all of Dr. Gray's podcasts. But what I especially love about your show is that I get to see my future life as a med student. Now that you have added some episodes on residency, I get even more excited when I see your logo pop up on my phone. I was hoping that you could discuss something that I am still struggling with on my pre-med journey. For a quick background on my question, I was raised by a single mom and we were poor enough that sometimes we had to go on food stamps. I grew up in Provo, and several of my teachers predicted that I would become a doctor, but I never believed them. My experience with doctors and especially their children made me believe that they were all wealthy white heterosexual elitists who drove expensive cars and were sadistic bullies who liked to cut people open. I've finally accepted that I must answer my calling to become a healer, despite my negative judgments and experiences. Frankly, we need more minorities like me in medicine who can personally relate to the struggles our patients face. The hegemony, enormous cost, and the aggressive nature of medicine concerns me sometimes. In fact, I recently heard Dave on your show express concern that some of his med students will lose their altruism after they start getting that big fat paycheck and prestige. I would like to know if any of your med students had similar reservations about medicine and how they made peace with how medicine is practiced today. Thanks so much for everything you do. Samuel.
Samuel, thanks for your question. Appreciate that. A lot to unpack in Samuel's question here. Where do you want to start?
So, all right, let's, I think we got to just unpack like each point.
In a,
like, sure.
Unpack it for us, Mark.
So, let me unpack.
Begin.
So the question was, how do medical students manage the reservations of losing themselves in the process? Is what I took it as.
Is there
any other sub facets to that?
I think he also was talking about feeling that there needed to be more people who understood what it was like to struggle in life in order to relate to their patients. Like, I think that was kind of like a sub point that he brought up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, sure. I mean, first of all, the easiest one to dispense with, the easiest, statement he has to not dispense with, but to deal with is, yes, we need more minorities in medicine. That's totally clear. Fortunately, we have, a white man, two people with Jewish sounding names, but who are essentially Christian, a Middle Eastern Mexican, and a gay man in the room today. So we are diverse AF today.
Yeah.
All guys.
It's a problem. That's a problem. But I'm wearing women's underwear right now. So.
Oh. Good for you.
Medicine needs more minorities. It needs more people of all types to be helpful to patients of all types.
I think like one of the things people are afraid of is that this isn't unique to medicine, but like the idea of like quotas for different groups so that it's fair. And obviously like that's not the solution or like any path that we should entertain. Like we have that new dean that started here, Dean Jackson. Mm-hmm. And he said something really, and he had like a town hall with students, faculty and staff before, like when he was here for his interview. And he was talking about programs he'd put in place at his previous institution to make the physician workforce resemble the population it's caring for. And I thought that was like a very almost artful way of putting that. So that it's
interesting, yeah. I mean,
so that it reflects the demographics.
I don't know. I guess I have a problem like saying that it should be any specific way. I think that
sure.
You know, that it should be more and more. And I think that, you know, when you go through the admittance process to get into med school, it's really selecting more and more for people who are genuine and who actually have caring aspects of their personality and want to be in it, you know, primarily for that reason. And also that they like science and all of that stuff too. But that when you talk to them, you can tell that they're really listening to you and actually care. This actually reminds me of a TED talk that I listened to recently, and I forget the woman's name, but it was really interesting because she talked about how she what used to be like a very staunch feminist, and she kind of infiltrated and was interviewing and talking to men's rights groups and getting to know these people. And it was interesting because she kind of walked you through the process of her own awakening to what they were actually advocating for. And she's like, you know, I was so set in my idea of, you know, all men's rights groups are trying to take rights away from women, and that means this and that. And she's like, I was filtering everything that they said through that lens. And so I was kind of blinded to what they might have actually been saying. And anyway, long story short, she gets to the point at the end that she's like, you know, what I realized is that, you know, this isn't about, you know, that women need all of the resources or that men need all of the resources or everyone on this side is bad or everyone on this side is bad. It's really about coming together and kind of advocating for each other and what everyone needs. And I think that this kind of applies to this scenario too, in the sense that minority or not, you know, privileged, you know, white male or not, are you equipped?
Like how you pointed to me, I appreciate it.
Well, you're wearing the woman's underwear, so that's okay. Well, but you know, are you equipped emotionally and personally to do a good job as a physician?
But I think we've also learned that it's hard to be equipped emotionally to or intellectually to do things unless unless you understand what it is who it is you're doing them for.
Yeah. I think that's the power of diversity in medicine specifically. It's
I'm not advocating against
diversity. No, I know you're not. Right. No, I'm not implying that you are, Tony. But I think it's a good question to always ask is, you know, when you have a conversation regarding, you know, when you have a massive amount of qualified people to do a certain job and you're selecting 150, let's say here at Carver, what are you valuing? What are you trying to do by creating your criterion that you're going to utilize? And I think the goal when you start, discussing the idea of diversity is if you create an archetype of one individual that's getting in, you're going to have one type of result. And having those multiple perspectives makes a huge difference. So going back to kind of like what you were saying, Tony, the idea of empathy. I have my own preconceived notions of, you know, from my experiences, this is how things go. And if I have a problem, this is how I solve it. And it works pretty darn good for me. But it's not going to count, like you're saying, for a patient population that comes from a world of different places. Mm. If you can learn alongside others and they can offer what works for them, you just have another tool that allows you to empathize when you're dealing with patients and saying, you know, I'm not going to give you what works best for me in this solution, you know, in this problem. But, you know, kind of have that opportunity. I think it's the idea of not having the tools, actually. Let me take a step back. It's the idea of acknowledging you're not going to come up with a tool on your own.
Yeah.
And you have to slow down and listen to an individual and allow them to kind of formulate on their own with you what's going to work.
Be open to taking advice.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, that's the biggest gain that I've had coming out here to Iowa and meeting so many people from I mean, just walks of life that I've never encountered, you know, at 26, 27 walking in and totally just changing the way I think of like, yeah, that's totally awesome and valid ways of approaching something.
Yeah. Or I think it's interesting too, because I just want to point this out. I don't know about Levi, but I know for a fact, like Mark, and Rob and I are all older and have had different experiences, and you know, those experiences have kind of shaped who we are. So it's interesting to be answering that from this question from that perspective, because I don't know what it's like to kind of hop from the high school bubble to the college bubble to med school bubble and just succeeding at all costs, you know, all the time, and not really having to deal with, you know, diversity or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that that probably informs our insight into this maybe a little bit more than some other people. I'm not sure.
What about Samuel's perspective of doctors being rich white elitist sadists?
Somewhat true.
Does he have a point?
What?
I mean, you know, like
far be it from me, multifaceted is my thing. Yeah. You know, and you know, the idea of minority status, you know,
being an antidote to that.
I feel like they're just separate things. And that's the big thing too. That's going to cross all lines. And even the one individual is multifaceted. You know, I might be a minority in one aspect, but then in another, I'm complete. You know, as a guy, I feel like medical school was made for people like me. It's catered towards my personality traits. So, you know, there's ways I'm going to find myself, you know, massively in the majority, and then others, not so much. So I would hesitate to typify doctors as white males. I think those were all majority.
I think those were true.
The
Double AMC reported like just a couple weeks ago though,
just
that
over
there
50%.
There's more women in medical school than men for the first time ever. So I mean, then again, women have been the majority of students in college for a while now too. So it's good that medical school reflects that too.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding nice cars, I will have Samuel know that I drive a crappy 2003 Mercury Sable.
You're not a doctor yet, though.
When you become a doctor, will you upgrade your lifestyle? I mean, you know, I know residency, that's like a no man's land in terms of like, you know, money and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you have money, but
so
it's not awesome money. But when you get to be like a real doctor, I can't remember, what are you, family medicine?
Pathology.
So I don't know what, I don't know. On
so
the
my husband and I have discussed this at length, actually.
Oh, okay.
So he's a pharmacy student. And so we're both going to be in training for a while, but we refuse to like, we don't need anything better than like a Chevy or a Toyota. Like,
cars are absurd.
Why?
It's a tool. That's the thing that gets me with like spending massive amounts. I didn't mean to cut you off, Rob.
No. I mean,
it's a tool.
Yeah.
But it's a nice tool.
I mean, anyone that knows me knows that I like nice things for sure. But that doesn't mean that I need to be a jerk about it either. Like, it's like, will I get eventually a $40,000 car? Probably, but does that automatically equate me to a sadist that has no feelings? I'd like to think not.
The guy that I, the physician that I worked with for family medicine, happened to drive a Jaguar, and he was one of the most caring, empathetic people I've ever met in my life, who is like absolutely committed to service as a principal. So
yeah,
he's also not white.
Also what?
Not white.
Okay.
So it's I'd be hesitant to paint people with a broad brush.
Yeah.
So brashly to consider.
I would.
We're growing up in America. The thing is, we're already in the richest segment of the world.
Yeah.
So the idea of like where that spectrum ends, you know, if it's a 96 Ford Explorer versus a, you know, 2017 Jaguar, we're all doing pretty darn great. And I think it's, I'm not going to judge somebody based on the car they drive. I'm not going to buy one though.
I probably wouldn't even notice.
It's not
important to me.
I see what Samuel is saying with this whole line of you know, rich white elitists, male sadists. I keep saying sadists because I think that's the best part. But
we cut people.
Okay. It's also really cut people. Very creepy to hear the word "sata" said in a robot voice. I'll just throw that out there.
I just like the pause with people and who cut people.
I would encourage Samuel to, you know, do whatever he can to mitigate that perception of doctors being all one way, because they're not.
No way.
Do they skew in a certain direction? Yeah, but no.
I mean, there's a substantial portion of any class that have parents that are physicians,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
my dad is a dreaded chiropractor. So,
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. Thanksgiving must be fun.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's like 1 in 5 nationally.
I'm not sure what the statistic is.
A pretty impressive amount.
Yeah, it's a pretty significant amount.
Yeah. There's value in like, make sure that doesn't become entrenched.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need the diversity of perspectives.
But, you know, and make sure that you do what you can, as I always emphasize, to, you know, not become that. Probably Samuel isn't going to become that, but who knows? You know, when I asked the larger group of co-hosts about Samuel's question, Casey also had some suggestions. Do whatever you can to remember your personal goals, one of which seems to be not becoming an a-hole.
A sadist.
And number two, prioritize. And this is interesting. Prioritize your self-interest so that you don't get bitter. I
think that's huge.
I think that's a big deal. Totally, I mean, it's so, mm-hmm. It would be so easy to just get, as we always say, it'd be so easy to just get lost in like doing for others all the time.
Yeah.
Reserve some of your attention for yourself. Make volunteering a part of your life. And actively work to remain self-aware by doing things like meditating, writing, debriefing with friends and mentors. You know, reach out to other people, I think is important. And she went on to say that medicine, like many professions, can isolate you from the day-to-day experiences of the people you're serving. And it's easy to forget them unless you're making some effort to actively focus on that aspect of medicine all the time.
I think acknowledging the system is going to make you different too from...
Yeah.
The average individual, just the levels of school and education and the fantasy world of some government somewhere.
Yeah.
To check every 6 months in my bank account.
I mean, my guess is...
I mean, that's just so bizarre to me still. It always just makes me kind of laugh a little bit of like, just money shows up in my bank account and then I spend it and they just trust that I'm good for it. Like, it's really interesting. And it totally separates us. It insulates us from like a lot of normal fears of the average person. I think you just got to accept that. You're going to be different.
And I think, Samuel, you're already, I don't know, maybe I don't have any right to make this generalization, but as somebody who A, was poor, B, was encouraged by his teachers to pursue this dream. It's not as common as we might like to think.
Mm-hmm.
And... C, who sees himself as becoming a physician someday, you're already, you know, you're already becoming somebody different than maybe you were a long time ago. I mean, that's just part of life. You're changing. You're becoming somebody new.
I mean, true, though. I think that once you, I don't know, for me, it's like I was in music school for a year, and it's like once I decided in high school at the ripe age of like 16 or whatever I was at the time, that's what I wanted to do. It's like, I took like AP bio and what, but I didn't take like AP chem or AP physics or any of that stuff. Cause it's like, I'm a musician.
I'm not going to need that.
I'm going to do, I'm not going to need that. And so just by having that interest and that being something that's very important to me,
mm-hmm.
I automatically started putting myself in a specific group.
Yeah.
And then you get influenced and kind of take on personality traits or develop certain characteristics that are characteristic of that group. So I think that that's only natural.
I tried to explain this to my son recently, who sees himself. He's a composer, actually. He's been working on his composing chops at the age of 13. And he's teaching himself music theory and all this kind of stuff. And, you know,
but he was letting some other
dad things. Humble brag. That's what's going on right
but,
now.
Well, yeah,
you
but,
know, I raised a prodigy.
Prodigy.
I raised clearly my father did not, but you, but you're raising a prodigy.
I raised some progeny.
Shut the fuck up. So, but my point is, God, I'm all red now. It's true. It was a little humble brag there. I'm not gonna go against that. But I did have to explain to him that, you know, you can't just do these things to the exclusion of everything else. You have to remember that, you know, you're not allowed to have one specific path yet. You've still got to do the math, and you've still got to do the literature, and you've still got to do the home ec or whatever they call it now. Home arts, you know.
Is it family and consumer
family,
sciences?
Yes, that's what it is.
Wait, what is that?
Family and consumer science.
They call it in Iowa anyway. So, you know, anyway.
It's a very non-offensive way of putting it.
Yeah.
What if you're cooking for one?
I don't know.
Yeah, there you go. I'm cooking for one.
I guess I'm like the old guy's like, I don't know what was wrong with the term home economics. It's home, it's economics, you know, what the...
It's everything you needed.
Well, for God's sake.
I think the wisdom of what Casey was saying too is a big part of like, you're going to change, be mindful of where you're headed.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in that.
Don't lose yourself.
Yeah. Accept the change, but be mindful of what you're changing to.
Samuel, thank you for writing in. Thank you, Armand, for your call. If you have something you want to ask us and that we can expound at length for like 40 minutes, we are happy to hear from you at theshortcoats@gmail.com or at 347-SHORT-CT. Or any number of other ways we have out there to for you to express those ideas and questions. How many of you play video games?
On occasion.
Used to pretty heavily. I don't think I have in... Oh, gosh.
I played Halo in high school.
Mm-hmm. Quake was the game that I played, but I don't play video games.
I like Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh.
Ooh, I remember that.
That was a Star Wars game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Do you own game machines now? I mean,
I have an Xbox, but I use it for Netflix and TV.
Right.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Right. I still have a PC.
Beware, says the WHO. WHO is about to add gaming disorder as a mental health problem in next year's update of the International Classification of Diseases. Symptoms include social isolation, trouble transitioning from one thought to another, reduction in empathy, loss of appetite, and loss of sensory perception. So basically, medical school.
Is there a time bait? It is a game.
Yeah. Persists for at least a year.
A year? Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Not everyone agrees with this idea. One group of 28 scholars wrote an open letter regarding the proposal, criticizing it for a lack of scientific support. Speaking of evidence-based... medicine, a lack of transparency, failure to adequately consider the clinical harms and human rights concerns of the proposed diagnosis. I'm not really sure what the human rights concerns would be, except maybe just labeling people as something or as having something.
I don't know. I think that that's kind of ridiculous. It seems like that can be broken down into
the concern or the diagnosis?
The diagnosis.
Oh, okay.
I think that that can easily be broken down into like an anxiety disorder or like a social isolation type of thing, mm-hmm. or something that's more concretely established.
So the distinction between symptom and
and
disease, mm-hmm. or
I think that that's more of a symptom of what's going on than the actual cause of, if in an extreme situation, someone's playing 10 plus hours of video games a day, that's not actually the problem. It's kind of the Band-Aid for what the problem actually is.
Kind of like sex addiction.
Or gambling,
it would fall under like an addiction thing, or some of those characteristics were just basically schizoid personality traits.
Yeah, I'm not really sure why you couldn't have an umbrella definition for these addictions, which all
with
have
a video game subtype.
Yeah.
Could just make like a
subtype VD was already taken.
Well, maybe. Maybe.
That's very good.
Maybe what they're talking about as far as human rights is concerned is that even the WHO has acknowledged that they're under a certain amount of pressure, quote, especially from Asian countries, to include the disorder. Countries like South Korea and China both have sort of authoritarian regimes. And
South Korea.
I'm pretty sure North Korea is not like showing up to like Dota tournaments and stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. This is what was written.
So, I know it's South Korea. I don't know if they're authoritarian.
I looked at it twice, and maybe it was a typo. Because I looked at it twice and was like, really? South Korea? I'm like, all right, I'll just include it. But anyway, countries that have authoritarian regimes and who also limit access to the internet and limit access to technology out of some fear that it's bad for their population. I think maybe that's what they're talking about with human rights. Human rights issues. But they're not alone. Apparently, the APA is also suggesting an internet gaming disorder as a possible diagnosis.
Yeah. It kind of seems like a first world problem. I feel like you can distill it down to something more fundamental than
it's a manifestation of something else.
Yeah. I also think maybe it's just another, you know, like, oh, it technology bad, sort of knee jerk reaction that every generation has had, you know, radio, television, mm-hmm. Internet, gaming, social media, cell phones, they're all demonized or have been demonized in the past.
I read this, like it was an old editorial. I think it was from like the early 1900s, New York Times, talking about how nobody talks on the train anymore. Everybody just sits there and reads the newspaper. And I'm just like,
that'd be a pleasant
change.
That
would be considered charming now.
Newspaper, what's that?
It's that thing you get on your phone, right?
Yeah.
There's also a proposal. Well, there's a bit of research that I read anyway. An effort underway to explore a disorder called selfieitis. So
inflammation of the selfie?
Inflammation related to the taking of selfies.
My selfie is swollen.
Called narcissism.
That's photosensitivity.
In 2014, there was a widely reported hoax news story about the condition involving the obsessive taking of selfies, which said that the APA was classifying as a mental disorder with sub-classifications of borderline, acute, chronic. Turned out that was somebody made that up, and it was, you know, a classic internet hoax. But in November, researchers published a study attempting to explore the idea. They interviewed 225 Indian university students and then used the information gathered on why people take selfies to create a questionnaire that results in a score on their selfieitis. I think it's selfieitis behavior scale. They then validated the scale with a bunch more Indian university students. Factors contributing to selfieitis: environmental enhancement. If you're somewhere enjoyable, you want to memorialize it.
That's an interesting... Sorry, keep going.
Social competition, competing with others by presenting a view of one's life as better in some way. Attention-seeking. Yeah. Attention-seeking. Look at me. I'm cool. Mm-hmm. Mood modification. For some, it makes selfie takers feel better when they are down. Take a selfie and they feel better. Self-confidence. When people like and comment on one's selfies, one feels better about themselves. And social conformity. Some people feel that taking selfies enhances their membership in their social groups. What were you going to say?
That's super interesting. I just never thought about that. Like, if you could create, like, predictive factors of, like, a selfie occurring.
Yeah.
And then what does that say about...
Low self-esteem.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can all relate to these things in one way or another, you know, like...
We've talked about it a couple times, sure. Dave, of getting Instagram accounts and then sitting on there. And
right.
The first year that I had it, I would take a picture almost every day of something throughout my day.
Right.
And then I'd get, you know, put there... Spend 5 minutes looking for the right, you know, filter. Always always settle on sepia for whatever reason. And then I'd get to the, you know, I have to type something and I'd realize, like,
yeah,
nobody needs to see this.
Right.
This is just...
We will probably never develop selfieitis because we are not confident that gives a rat's ass.
It's a flip of confidence of, like, nobody cares about this. I'm going to get rid of it. Nobody wants this. But, like, a whole year of doing that every day. Yeah, and then eventually you finally put one out there. So I feel like confidence can cut both ways.
Yeah, I think there's like a distinction between people who like really sort of obsess over things like, you know, the right filter. And I only increase the contrast. That's all I do.
That's all you do?
If you follow my Instagram, first of all, they're all of my children. And second of all...
Dad bragging again.
Your progeny.
They're just pictures
child.
Of my son composing. Son.
Your composer.
Feverishly writing away.
Hashtag child progeny.
I've heard that he's never erased any of his compositions. He's kind of like a Mozart reincarnation.
Well, they are all posted on Instagram. So,
dang. Oh,
interesting.
Nice. Yes,
as videos. Nice. So,
it's like one of those things that was like, it was so cringeworthy, like even 5 years ago. And then it's like, I on the bus on the way here today, I saw somebody what appeared to be outside the dental college. Not that this stands for everybody at the dental college, but like somebody appearing to like
we have to be
Facebook
very careful.
Liveing, and they like gestured to the snow outside, and I'm just like, come on.
Maybe they just got their teeth cleaned, and they're like, my teeth are as bright as the new fallen snow.
They're still dicks.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just stop taking pictures of your face.
Maybe they're visiting from the coast. They're like, what is this?
That's right. You can't make assumptions here, Rob.
I painted with a broad brush.
Well,
I need to learn my own lessons.
Gotta be careful.
And it's like the part of that was like, you know, they're taking it as a memento in a place that they're at. It's like, take a picture of the environment then. Like, just take a picture of the landscape and call it good.
Mm-hmm.
Why does your face need to be in it?
I memorialize places by taking pictures of people taking selfies.
I thought you were going to say something very different there than what you actually said.
He actually lifts a leg and pees on the environment. Yeah.
I thought that was going a completely different direction. Mm-hmm. I was wrong.
I don't know if he does that or not. I hope not.
I hope the selfie habit dies.
Okay.
It falls out of fashion.
It'll probably get worse.
But then it will die.
I think it'll
be replaced by something else.
I'm sure it's something better and worse.
Yep.
What would replace it?
Let's not.
Do you want to give anybody ideas?
Maybe people will post their own like MRIs, like really see inside of them, not just the surface.
Oh my gosh,
you know, getting deep here.
Yeah. What were you gonna say, Mark?
Was there something that the selfie replaced? What would be the equivalent? You know, back in the
self portrait.
Back in the day,
lips.
A daguerreotype.
But that's another part of a selfie
subtype.
Yeah. I don't remember. I guess.
Oh, the mirror picture. That's what it was. It's still a
the mirror
selfie,
picture.
But the thing is, it's not directed at you.
Like from MySpace?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You got the flash,
I didn't know
the sunburst in the corner.
The mirror selfies.
Yeah.
I didn't know that that was, that predated selfies, though.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like it does.
Definitely.
Because that was before the front-facing camera.
I see.
You know, when technology was just so primitive.
That makes a lot
we had to use mirrors.
I will not rest until the only acceptable depiction of oneself is an oil painting, as God intended.
Yeah, you know what? That's fine. If you paint an oil painting of yourself, you can post that online.
But only if it's good.
That's how I feel about. Side note: this is how I feel about singers. On, you know, if you're singing and you're getting paid for it. Right. Like you're in a concert or you're on television or whatever. If you're singing, you damn well better not be flat.
Oh, I agree.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I have no respect for any band or musician that I hear that sounds like crap live.
Yeah.
That bothers me big time.
Anyway.
What if you're famous, but not famous?
But what if they're hot?
Then don't sing.
You know me so well, Rob. So,
what's the name of the guy, Fast and Furious?
Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel. Does anyone follow, speaking of selfies, his Instagram?
No.
I do not.
Hop on there, and there are videos upon videos of him singing.
Oh.
What?
Like,
really?
Yeah. No. He's just, like, singing over the radio. But, I mean, he put some effort into it. Like, there's a room. It's impressive. It's so fascinating.
Wait,
like,
you're telling me that he put in enough effort that he's in a room?
He's like got a space, I'm assuming, somewhere in his home. There's enough to where I think it's in his home.
You can afford that with Tokyo Drift money.
Know, right?
That's true.
But gets all dressed up and we'll just sing over a track on the radio. And it's, I don't know why, it's so fascinating.
Probably therapeutic.
He's not getting paid for
probably.
It.
Probably. He's not, but it's the same thing of like...
Is he holding like an Armani shoe or something? Because like that's a thing on Instagram.
Is it?
Well, I mean, where you get paid for your product.
Oh, gotcha. No. That's
my husband was showing me last night. There's this... she's like a dermatology resident. And then her husband's also some kind of resident. And there's all this product placement. Mm. And I'm like...
Oh,
what kind of money are we talking?
Yeah, Rob's like all about that.
The thing that comes
and then I'm like, no, I have principles. I would not do that.
I'm going to wrap this up because that's our show. I hope we all learned something here today, or at least that you're still listening at this point.
Y'all, thank you so much for hanging out with me.
It was a pleasure.
I could tell by the long pause. And thank you, listeners, for making us a part of your week. If you like what you heard today, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, formerly known as iTunes. I'm trying to break the habit. Or wherever you listen to us. Talk about just about anything you like in our Facebook group, the Short Code Student Lounge. You can always send us your thoughts, questions, comments, ideas, and hate mail to theshortcodes@gmail.com or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. Swear to God, we will answer all questions and respond to all comments. They are important to us. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and ongoing support from the Writing and Humanities program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Box, and our closing music is by Cabin's Bear. Talk to you in 1 week.
Don't be a sadist.